From Hollywood, this is Out of My Mind. I'm Jay Douglas, and in episode 5, we're going from the head of the line to the coffee legacy of Robert Young by way of our inbox. We'll also spend some time in 1955 with an accidental cultural icon, all in about 17 minutes. That's what we do each week. We search for the essential, the non-essential, and the curiously essential information every baby boomer needs to know. And if you're not a baby boomer, you'll need to know this someday anyway, so why not start now? You're welcome to listen too, as episode 5 of Out of My Mind begins with some awful stuff. Like many of us, I trusted Robert Young when he said that Sanka made a great cup of coffee without all that caffeine. It didn't take me long to realize Father didn't always know best, something I often heard from my mother. That started my search for a good cup of decaf, because I can't drink regular coffee. Recently, my quest brought me to Adam Scott Paul. He's the co-founder of the L.A. Coffee Club. The club ships dozens of coffees from specialty roasters to people all over the world, and I asked him which one of those coffees made the best cup of decaf.
Any coffee can be processed to become decaf.
Removing caffeine is apparently straightforward and can be done with pure water.
So this process of running the beans through the water solution, removing all of that water and processing them again until the beans are 99.9% caffeine free.
Well, this is easy. All I have to do is find a coffee company that uses its best beans in its decaf coffees. And from what Adam said, that meant specialty roasters. From Sanka all the way up to today's major coffee brands, large companies have to buy the best beans available to meet customer demand. But best beans available doesn't always mean the best beans.
From a corporate perspective, they have to buy coffee that's available. And that means that it might be more of a commodity level coffee. In terms of specialty coffee, the batches that we roast are much smaller. The farms that we buy from are much smaller. And we are looking for the highest quality there is.
So which roaster did he recommend? Actually, none of them. It seems the decaffeinating process comes with a small side effect.
It changes the look of the coffee majorly. And if you compared a green coffee that was caffeinated versus the very same coffee that was decaffeinated, visually, your appetite would steer you towards the caffeinated one, because the decaffeinated one looks somewhat maybe moldy or dirty, or it doesn't have a uniform quality about the bean. And when you roast coffee, you want to look for a coffee that is as consistent as possible. Each bean is going to cook at a different rate if it's not all the same. That may lead back to why decaf doesn't taste as good as caffeinated coffee, is because each bean inside the roast has a different moisture content, density, etc.
I couldn't help feeling I'd been a little hard on Robert Young, and that maybe I was looking for something that doesn't exist.
I have had in my life a decaf coffee. I was surprised that it was a decaf, and more people that look for specialty coffees are starting to break into that territory. And so new non-chemical processes may result in great things to come.
Adam Scott Paul is the co-founder of the LA Coffee Club, and he's left me with a ray of hope. If you've had a great cup of decaf, let me know the details. Go to bit.ly/OOMM123 and click on episode 5. Follow the link to show notes. I've set up a special coffee alert page for you to share your experiences. If we use your experience on the show, I'll send you a bag of specialty roasted decaf coffee from Adam's collection. You'll also find a link to the LA Coffee Club website and information on its coffee sampling service. And you can listen to Adam's tips for making a great cup of coffee, decaf or not. Everybody wants to be at the head of the line these days, even if they're not sure what they're going to do once they get there. If you've ever been to a book signing at your local bookstore, you know I'm speaking the truth. People who have waited 15, 20, 30 minutes or more planning what they're going to say to an author turn into blocks of stone or pillars of jello when it's their turn to speak. Karen Maya de Allman is the events coordinator for the Elliott Bay Book Company in Seattle, Washington. And she's seen this happen so many times, she's equipped with suggestions on what you can say the next time you hear the words, "To whom should I inscribe this book?"
It hasn't been mentioned in the talk. Sometimes people will ask their favorite authors, well, what are you reading? What do you love right now? And usually authors are really glad to recommend other books.
But Karen says you shouldn't shy away from being more personal. Writing is an intimate act between author and reader, and Karen recommends sharing how a book affected you.
If you have got a question or comment that comes from the heart, just say it. These kinds of comments and questions mean much more than you would know to many authors. For example, Chuck Palahniuk often hears in signing lines that his book, Fight Club, or maybe one of the other ones, is the first book that a person has ever read all the way through, or this is the first book that my grandson loved, and I'd really like you to sign this to him. That means a lot, and he really takes a lot of time with his audiences for that reason. David Sedaris, a very, very famous author, but people share all kinds of stories with him in line, things such as stories of weight loss, knowing that he also deals with those issues and writes about such things. People talking about dealing with their drug addiction. Here's one of the best stories. So I was in the signing line for David McCullough, and at the end, there was a woman who said that 40 years ago, she worked with him at USIA, and their boss was Edward R. Murrow. I think she was a little shy about it, but she told me this story, and I said, oh, you must say something to him. He caught up with her actually in the parking lot afterwards, and they had a little chat. So don't be afraid to say things like that.
However, there are a few things you should be afraid to say or do.
Sometimes people get very, very exuberant and want to hug the authors, and some authors are really into that. But a lot of authors, and especially if there's a really huge crowd and you're trying to get to everybody in a small amount of time, that's kind of tough.
Asking an author to read your manuscript is also something you should avoid. There are better and more appropriate ways to get your work into the hands of an author.
There are ways to contact authors for that kind of thing, usually done through an agent or through a publisher.
You won't find a more knowledgeable and helpful group of booksellers anywhere in the country than the staff at the Elliott Bay Book Company in Seattle, Washington, where Karen Maya de Allman is the events coordinator. You can always make use of Karen and her colleagues' expertise by visiting the Elliott Bay Book Company website. I've put a link to it in the show notes. A moment, please, for a tip of the hat to you for your feedback on the show. Most of it has been encouraging, and for that I'm grateful. It's rewarding to know that what we do here in about 17 minutes every week is interesting enough to keep you coming back. The segment that did get the most comments was Mark Horowitz's look at The Magic Christian, a film from 1970 starring Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr. Typical of the comments were, "I will look forward to more of Mark's reviews." Another listener wrote that she was so intrigued by Mark's description of the film, she immediately went online and ordered a copy of the DVD. Rest assured that Mark will be back in a few weeks to talk about another film we may have missed while we were busy growing up. I love hearing from you, and if you have a comment or suggestion for the show, you too can go to bit.ly/OOMM123. Click on Episode 5, and you'll find different ways to send your feedback. One of them is sure to be to your liking. In 1955, NBC president Sylvester L. Weaver, better known as Pat, thought he was solving a major problem. Instead, he created a cultural icon that most baby boomers not only remember, but remember fondly. This is the story of Pat Weaver's Radio Folly. This is the story of Monitor.
Stand by, Davenport.
Okay, hello, Walter McGraw. Good, be with you in a minute.
Okay.
This is Monitor and Walter Kiernan at NBC's Radio Central.
WWJ Detroit and Carl Cederberg.
For that story, Monitor goes to Davenport, Iowa, and
now a late bulletin, International News Service report.
Taking a look at the Monitor baseball scoreboard.
Birdland, Unchained Melody.
Here's a bird that just landed, our television monitor, Henry Morgan.
Right now, this is Monitor going places and doing things. Take
one to the Blue Note in Chicago this time, and the...
out of the embers in New York and the monitor music of Jack Elliott Trio.
And now to the United States Weather Bureau in Washington. Your monitor takes you now to Walter McGraw and San Quentin Prison. Come in, Jim Cahill, and tell us where you are and how goes the
fight. Monitor goes now to Hamburg, Germany. Right now, the man who made Drudel a household term, Roger Price.
To the Palladium in Hollywood and the monitor music of Les Brown.
In Detroit, negotiations to avert a General Motors strike continue.
Now, for an this is Ben Grauer.
Walter Carradine.
Morgan Beatty.
And Miss Monitor.
All of us saying good night.
All of that occurred in the last hour of the first day of Monitor Radio in 1955. It began as all hours did with the somewhat techy, somewhat eerie sound of the monitor beacon. And it continued at that frenetic pace for 20 years. Every weekend, Monitor used the technology of the day to span the globe and also to pull it together. That may not have been Weaver's intention. He was looking for a way to save NBC Radio, because NBC needed the money from radio to fund its new television network. Weaver hoped to extend the life of the NBC Radio network by a few more years. His critics called him crazy.
Everything he did at NBC, people thought, you're crazy, it will never work. Remember, at first, he opened up the morning hours with the Today Show. Television networks did not broadcast from 7 until 9 o'clock until Pat Weaver put on the Today Show in 1952, and everybody thought he was crazy. Who's going to watch a show in the morning? Well, as it turns out, everybody was going to watch that show in the morning, and it became the number one show in the morning very quickly and stayed there for decades. Then he opened up late night with the Tonight Show in 54. People said, that's never going to work. You know, local stations run, they do their 15 minutes of news, if they do news at all, and then they run their local movies in black and white. Who's going to watch Steve Allen hosting 105 minutes of this show out of New York called The Tonight Show? Who in the world cares about that? And as it turned out, The Tonight Show has been number one forever.
That's Dennis Hart. He's retired now, but he spent 40 years in radio and television broadcasting, and it all started with Monitor bringing a part of his world together.
I didn't communicate very well with my dad. He didn't communicate very well with me. But the one thing we both agreed upon was that we loved Monitor. And we listened to that show together. In the car, he'd have it on in the garage, at our house.
Dennis was so captivated by Monitor that after leaving grad school, he wrote the definitive book about the show. But let's get back to Pat Weaver's crazy idea for a moment and why it captivated not only Dennis, but a nation that was poised to leap into the age of computers and information.
Here was this incredible show that was more exciting than anything that was on TV because it was live and television wasn't. It kept you involved and instantaneously informed with what was going on in the world. Television was not equipped to do that. It could not go live instantaneously. Monitor could. So as excited as we are now, we talk about how people are changing the way they get information now, going away from the printed page to online. Well, here was Monitor. And so if you wanted to be entertained, if you wanted to be informed, Monitor was really the only place you could do it. In a strange way, but you can make the tie-in, it was the internet of its day.
The internet of its day? Well, like the internet, it offered a constant flow of information that you could access whenever you wanted to and wherever you were. And like social media does today, Monitor helped tie scattered groups together into a community, with everyone hearing the same stories at the same time from their radios.
You could tune in at 17 after the hour, at 33 after the hour, at 14 to the hour, and hear something different. Hear something new. And if you didn't like what you were listening to, you could just wait a couple of minutes and something different would come up. So I think Monitor became perhaps the first portable radio show just at the very moment when transistors were becoming portable for people to take places. In other words, people were no longer tied to their radios in the living room.
For Weaver, Monitor did what he knew it would do. It turned around the fortunes of NBC Radio.
Bear in mind that Nielsen could not measure radio audiences in automobiles. By Monitor's third weekend on the air, it was the number three radio program in the country in drive time, weekend drive time, 4 until 6 o'clock, 4 until 7. That wasn't counting anybody listening on the radio in their cars. This was at home listening. By the third weekend on the air, the fourth weekend on the air, Monitor is 97% sold out. The weekend before it went on the air in June of 1955, the entire NBC radio network schedule had two sponsored programs, only two.
What did people think of this 1955 internet? It doesn't take much to figure out that if sponsors liked the show, it must mean that's where the listeners were.
It reached 30 million people in the mid-1960s in a country of 180 million. One out of six Americans listened to Monitor every weekend. The top-rated syndicated show in the country right now is Rush Limbaugh's, and he reaches about 14 million on a weekly basis in a country of 315 million. So think about Monitor. 30 million people in a country of 180 million. That's unbelievable.
Monitor began broadcasting all day Saturday and Sunday for a full 40 hours a weekend. Eventually, NBC pulled that back to 16 hours. And then, in January 1975, the Monitor beacon went silent. It fell victim to too many forces. NBC Television was no longer in need of money from the radio division. Television could go live almost as quickly as radio. Radio stations were into playing music and weren't interested in being the internet of their day. Still, Monitor in its 20-year run matched pop music, rock and roll, disco and talk formats stride for stride. An incredible feat of broadcasting that will never be matched. To me, here's the real proof of the show's lasting impression. Dennis has put as many of the old Monitor shows as he could get his hands on onto CDs. And then...
when I drive into a gas station on a Saturday afternoon, I will have my windows down and I'll be playing Monitor very loudly. More than once at a gas station here in California and elsewhere across this country, I will have people come up to me who are filling their tanks with gas and they'll say, I haven't heard that sound in years, especially if it's the Monitor beacon. God, I loved listening to that show. Is that back? And I have to tell them, it's back only for me.
Monitor can be back for you too. Dennis has a website full of Monitor memorabilia, including hours of original broadcasts you can listen to. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, along with some additional memories Dennis has about the show. I want to thank Dennis Hart for sharing his knowledge of Monitor with us. In the spirit of full disclosure, I began Out of My Mind because I too was inspired by Monitor, and like Dennis, believed that if someone brought it back, people would listen. So, how are we doing? Visit bit.ly/OOMM123 and click on Episode 5. There you'll find several ways to get in touch with the show and let us know how we're doing and what we can do better. Speaking of pulling the plug, that's going to do it for Episode 5 of Out of My Mind. Thank you for being a part of the program. There'll be a new one for you next Saturday morning at 8 Eastern, and I'll talk to you then. I'm Jay Douglas. Out of My Mind is produced by Penny Summers and is a production of the Theater of Your Mind, Incorporated, Hollywood, California. Dennis, you still there?
Yes, I am, Jay.
I know you've always wanted to do this, so go ahead.
You're on the Monitor Beacon. Take one.